Hey everybody, this is Alex Lindsay, and this is the VFX show, the visual effects show. I'm here with Ron Brinkman, and the two of us have been kind of chatting about putting together this little podcast, and mostly just dealing with visual effects. I think we're going to start off by reviewing stuff. Now, Ron and I both have a bit of a visual effects background. Ron has done a lot of visual effects himself. He's worked on some software. And Ron, I'll actually let you flesh out your background. For everyone,
I can do that. Yep. Right now, I'm at Apple Computer. I'm the product designer for the Shake software, which is compositing visual effects compositing software, and pretty much have been doing that since the beginning of that product back before we were part of Apple. And then, like Alex says, have a background in doing visual effects related things as well here and there. I've worked on a handful of movies back in the day.
Now, did you mostly deal with compositing? Is that was most of your background?
Or? No, pretty much everything. I mean, when I started at Sony ImageWorks, well, there was about five of us there when I started at Sony ImageWorks. It was a while back. Sony ImageWorks, for people that don't know, is probably the second or third, it might even be the biggest visual effects company out there right now. And but yeah, when I first started, there was five of us. So my background was more in 3D, but the nature of a small, starting in visual effects kind of company is that you tend to get your feet wet doing compositing. So that's really where I started getting into compositing. And it's a great kind of a basis for everything. Even if you end up doing 3D, just understanding what compositing does, that's really where everything's kind of pulled together. So, I mean, I was, supervising by the time I left there and dealing with everything, but,
I will say before we jump into our the meat of the show, I will say that I usually consider compositing the center of the production pipeline. So most of what actually happens in your compositor, and whether it's Photoshop or your 3D app or your video, a lot of times I look at all of that feeding into your compositor to figure out that's actually what's going to create a lot of what you actually see, and when you have to know compositing well, in my opinion.
I totally agree. It really is where everything gets finished. I mean, the cynical view is it's where everything flows downhill to, and then you're at the end of the chain, and you get to fix everything. But by the same token, you're also the guy that really brings everything together and integrates it.
I personally think you can't be a good 3D artist without understanding compositing. And I worked in my background a little real shortly. For those of you, I think most people will know who I am, but the who are listening to this because of the other shows that we do. But I worked in the Rebel Mac unit, so I was part of ILM's little experimental unit. There was 10 or 12 of us that worked on Star Wars Episode One, a couple other movies, and we got to do everything. So we got to do a little bit of 3D, a little bit of compositing, modeling, all those things. And having that kind of rounded background was really, really important. But one of the most important things at the time was compositing, because you look at 3D completely differently when you're doing that. So one of the things that we're hoping to do during this show, we're going to start the show off, and we'll probably dig into what you're going to probably find us doing is, we'll talk about a specific movie that just came out, but around it, we'll also try to outline, Ron and I, and probably we'll have some other guests on as we move forward, we'll try to outline some of the techniques and some of the things to watch for while you're watching these movies, and while you're and what we're watching for while we're breaking something down, while we're watching for it when we're working on the shot. And so hopefully it'll help you educate your eye towards good visual effects and bad visual effects. I think that one of the best places to learn a lot of this stuff is actually just going to the movies. So
absolutely. Just
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it's when you work in the biz, you do learn to catch a few things that you might not see at first glance. But I think a lot of what we want to talk about too is not just the technical aspects, but also hopefully some of the creative decisions that go into some of these things and shot design and all of that.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we used to say a lot was that the thing to realize with a lot of these things is you never actually finish a visual effects shot. You mostly give up. Mm-hmm. It's
good. You ship your last test, and then the show's over.
So a lot of this stuff, when we look at it, it's as far as it was going to go. And some movies, that is as far as it needs to go. And sometimes you wish they went a little further. So
yeah, and also it's worth making the point that even if we do end up being a little bit critical about certain shots or shows. We've kind of all been there, and it's, you know, most of the time, it's not necessarily the fault of the artist that worked on it. There's so many other factors that come into to play there, and you know, it's a business. There's budgets. There's tremendous time constraints on some of these things, and somewhere somebody makes a decision that has to be good enough, and that doesn't necessarily reflect badly on the individuals that worked on it. So.
I created very bad shots for Star Wars.
Yeah, as we all have, I'm sure.
there's just before we get into it, there's actually a shot where the Queen ship jumps into hyperspace, and if anyone actually watches it on the DVD, you'll notice that half the star, it looks like there's not very many stars because I forgot to turn one of the models on. So but once it was in the film, it was like, ah, it's good enough. So anyway.
Yep.
So a lot of that we'll dig into. I think we're starting off with a great movie, and this one was actually a little harder to review. One of the things we're going to start off, and a lot of today's show is going to be wrapped around Mission Impossible 3, of course. We wanted to start the show around dealing with, we're going into the effects, really the effects heavy movie releases over the summer. And so we thought this would be a good time to do it. And so the first weekend that we started going out and seeing stuff, Mission Impossible 3 was the big movie coming out. And I thought, you know, overall, I mean, creatively, okay, before we start talking about the visual effects, Ron, what did you think of the film overall?
I enjoyed it. I actually enjoyed it quite a bit. You know, it was, I was trying to think back to the other two, which kind of blur together in my mind. But overall, yeah, I think it was pretty involving. You know, I thought interesting characters, and yeah, it was interesting because I felt like a lot of the effects and everything were, in some ways, almost smaller in scale. They were more about sort of individual action stuff instead of really. I mean, there's a lot of big things going on, but I think they did a good job of balancing that with some of the, you know, individual smaller action pieces too.
Oh, creatively, as far as the entire film goes, I think that I personally think it's the best Mission Impossible of the three.
Yeah, I kind of think so too.
I think the story was the most coherent and it made the most sense as far as Mission Impossible theme can make sense. I mean, a lot of times, you know, everything's a little outstretched and everything else, but I really felt like it was. I enjoyed it. I actually, because we were reviewing this, I've already seen it twice, and both times I, you know, had a fine time. And there's a lot of movies nowadays that I get really bored in, and so So this was, I thought, it was a really, really good entertainment overall. Now, how did you, before we get into any individual shots, what did you think of the overall quality of the visual effects within the film?
It was quite good. I mean, I went into it looking for, because, you know, I wanted to make sure that I kind of set myself the goal going into it is, all right, at least be able to say what the worst shot in there was. And, you know, you do have to try and look for where some of the flaws were. But it was pretty clean, I thought. It was quite good. And I, again, not to rag on anybody in particular, but I think ILM, which is the effects facility that did it, they do sometimes turn out stuff that sort of just skims that good enough border sometimes, particularly with matte edges and some things like that. But I actually thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of I think with a lot of films that have a lot of visual effects, you almost can't help but skim some of those good enough in some of the shots, because if you're dealing with 1,000 shots or 1,500 shots, or in this case, I think, what was there, 500 and 500?
Yeah, there was over 500 shots in there. 520 is what somebody told me.
Yeah, so it's a lot. That's a lot of visual effects shots. When Jurassic Park came out, I remember it was like 80 visual effects shots or something. And it was just enormous. Right. And now 520. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. And to compare that with War of the Worlds, you know, which is, you know, obviously got a lot of similarities, including Tom Cruise and being done at ILM. That was half as many shots. And you think of it, and, you know, you think of War of the Worlds, and there's the shots are obviously much more noticeable in terms of, you know, that the aliens and the ships and all that are effect shots. But, you know, I would be really hard pressed if I had to go through and pick out 520 shots in this film that I thought were the effect shots, because most of them were very, very seamless.
I thought it was amazingly seamless, because usually I get pulled out of the movie at least 10 or 15 times, you know, in most visual effects heavy films, of going, oh, bad compositor, oh, that, you know. And so I really did go in expecting to see some stuff that didn't work, and I was there was only a handful of shots that I really went, oh, that I know exactly what they did there. I know what they did there, but I know that didn't work. Overall, I was really looking for, I really didn't think that there were 520 shots.
I wouldn't have guessed that either. So go ahead. What's your stinker shot? If you had to pick one that jumped out at you the most.
I think the shot that I noticed the most, well, there's basically, for me, there's a handful of shots that, I wouldn't say the shot, but there was a handful of shots that didn't work for me. One is there was when the biggest one that jumped out, and it jumped out in the trailer, was when Tom Cruise gets pushed up against the car.
Right, when the explosion goes off behind him and he's sort of knocked sideways.
Yeah, there's something about the motion of his body that didn't work. Did you see that?
And I don't know if I agree. There is something about that shot that bugs me a little bit, but on the other hand, I remember when I first saw that shot in the trailer, I really liked the shot because it was, just from a design point, it sort of felt a little different than what I'd seen. You know, it wasn't the typical, oh, there's a fireball, 3 inches behind him, and he's, doing it. It felt a lot more real in some ways. I think there was some edgy sort of nature to it, but I also know that, I'm betting it was, a green screen shot, but I do know, I read somewhere or talked to somebody that, it really was Tom Cruise. He really was on some sort of a ratchet rig that kind of yanked him sideways into the car.
Right.
That he did put a dent in the car, so I'm not sure how much of the action. I mean, it's certainly possible in a situation like this too that the motion feels strange, but it's strange because it's not really from an explosion pushing him sideways. It's from a bungee cord yanking him sideways instead.
Yeah, maybe that's it. It was just there was something about the motion that didn't work for me, and so that is more of a special effects thing that he's got an explosion going on behind him, and then he's flying sideways, and so it might have just been more of a design issue than. If he had flown over camera or something like that, but of course it's very visually interesting to see it.
And that's it. I mean, ultimately, I'll give him credit for the shot standing out and seeming, and then the fact that he's knocked sideways, the windshield of the car blows out, he's on the ground, he starts to get up, there's a jet screams by going the other direction, kind of dark. It was an exciting shot.
Yeah, it was.
Even ignoring any of the technical stuff.
Right, and then some of the other ones. There's a shot where a missile misses a helicopter and it hits the bottom of a windmill. And in that shot, I thought that flames looked like they were composited in there. Live action flames were composited in there, and it didn't work. It didn't work. There was some, there was some kind of like weird layering or something going on there. And that's typical. You can get a lot of times when you're let's insert some flames there. Unless it's done really, really well, or unless you shoot actual practical elements from around surface, for instance, that's going to be a lot like what it's going to be there. It can oftentimes look a little odd. I don't know if that jumped out at you or not.
That one didn't jump out at me as much as there was a similar kind of thing on the bridge at one point where some of the missile running around stuff. Felt a little bit CG. I don't know what it is, but
did you notice the
smoke? Yeah, CG smoke trails. Yeah, still they're still not there. I don't know. At least I can still pick out that's a CG smoke and that's a practical element comped in or a live one. I mean, it's hard. I find it harder to tell a practical smoke element comped in usually than a CG one.
Yeah, the thing that typically looks odd about a CG smoke is that you'll see graininess. There'll be this odd graininess in the smoke that shows up, and when they comp a practical element, and it's really common. If you look at some of the digital, when you look at some of the distant shots, like my guess is, I don't know for sure, but my guess is when they leave, where they're leaving, the Vatican, you see off in the distance, you see smoke and stuff like that. That's the kind of thing you'd comp just some practical smoke in there to make it look good, but usually you want to use, if you can, practical elements to do that because it'll tend to look a little bit better. CG smoke's easier to control, and especially when you have missiles.
Yeah, you kind of have to do.
Yeah, you don't really have a lot of choice. There was a weird. Did you notice the gun throw between Tom and the one of the other the captured MIA agent? MIF angel.
Yeah, Felicity.
Felicity. Felicity was. Did you notice how many? By the way, just as a total side bar, did you notice all the different other things that J.J. Abrams have worked on. You know, there's people like...
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You got Felicity in there, and then one of the guys from Alias was in the party at the very beginning.
Yep.
You know, and so there was a couple of that. I thought that was cool.
Sure.
Yeah.
Anyway. That was cool. Yeah. If you looked at the effects credits, there's a guy, Kevin Blank, who's been an effects supervisor in some of the TV shows that did some of the work, too.
Right.
So, but yeah, the gun throw, I think we talked about this a little bit. I don't know if you looked at it again, if we talked about it before you saw it the second time or not, but I remember I looked at the trailer before I went and saw the film, and there was definitely something weird about it. And in fact, I stopped and looked at the trailer and stepped through, and it felt like there was a little bit of a jump. Then when I saw it in the theater, it didn't seem as bad, and I don't know if the trailer might have just been edited down a little bit to try and make it, you know, happen faster.
Well, I really did feel like there was the trailer is... Yeah, I don't know. It was when I saw it in the theater, I really did feel like there was something about the motion, and it doesn't. Mm-hmm. I guess when I look at the trailer, it doesn't even look that bad. But when I looked at it in the, it felt like it was just taking too long to get over there. I think that's it. I think that it's,
I mean, that's probably why they did it in the trailer. I think they cut it down a little bit to get it over faster.
And I think that actually might have made it look, I don't know, better or something. But I think when I watched the film, it just felt like it was taking longer than it should have. I think that was the thing that it just felt like it was hanging just a little too long in there. And I'm not sure, you know, what that was from. So you get into one of those things where a lot of times they're doing crazy stuff. Like he's throwing something and she's just acting like she's grabbing onto it. I mean, you know, I don't know whether that was a CG gun, but I would guess given how well a typical way to do that is have him throw it and then have her throw it. They play her backwards.
Right.
So, yep. And then you just, you put a CG one in between, ooh, and you match move it between the throws, and but that can be a really complicated thing to get all those plates to kind of, you know, come back together and
it could very well be that, you know, they shot it or they did it properly, and the director said, you know, I need that gun to hang there just a little bit more, so maybe everybody's sure they see it. You know, that's certainly not uncommon to get direction like that where the director, and rightly so, makes a call that, all right, it may not look 100% correct, but it makes the point that I want to make more,
right.
You know, more forcefully. And so, you know, you do it.
Exactly. Yeah. The last thing that I noticed, was the depth of field. I'm not sure if the depth, there was a lot of, number one, creatively, there was a ton of depth of field in the very shallow depth of field in the movie. Mm-hmm. So they really did a lot of, when you're looking at characters, what I mean by that, for those of you who are listening, is that they really had the subject in very tight focus, and then the background was very blurred out. And you can typically do that by opening up your aperture or zooming in or both, so that you get this, so it has a very short area that'll be in focus. The thing that was odd about it for me, and it totally could have been done in camera, or a lot of it could have been done in camera, but there were some rack focuses, so where they were jumping from focus from one person to another, that were almost too perfect, you know. And then there was a lot of times where I felt like the edges of their hair didn't look like, you know, it looked like someone had rotoed it and then done a depth of field.
I definitely noticed, even just on, I think he just loves a really shallow depth of field, because even on just some of the close up of faces and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. He kept it so narrow, that depth of field, that, you know, you'd have the eyes in focus and the lips would be out of focus and stuff like that, which I found a little distracting, you know, because if you happen to be looking at the mouth when you cut to that person and they're talking, and you know, your first reaction is the shot's, you know, it's out of focus, they miss the focus. Then you look up and you realize the eyes are in, but that's not necessarily where you're looking. So it could, I mean, there were so many green screen shots in here, I believe, that, you know, it's possible that since they had such a narrow depth of field on the original photography, that they were trying to match that.
I was noticing ones that were totally, that would have been totally live action shots. It just seemed like the depth of field, and there were a couple shots that, like, I couldn't figure out where the plane of focus would be to have all the certain items that were in focus. I couldn't figure out how they could be in focus and have the other things out of focus. You know, so there was a little bit of a, I feel like someone's adding some enhancing the focus issues.
It could be.
And it could be. I mean, that's something that you can totally creatively do and I do it a lot. I mean, I've done it in shots where you'll, especially in a green screen, it's easy, and in 3D it's easy. But a lot of times you'll blur out the background a little bit more, if you're adding one, or there are shots that I've done where we roto the shot and we blur, you know, or create a defocus that will, because the that short depth of field is going to focus your eye more on the subjects.
Yep.
So now, what did you think were the best shots? What did you like the most?
Well, let me get my bad shot first.
Okay. Whoa, I missed him. I didn't get it. What was your bad shot?
Some of the stuff you talked about, the other one that jumped out at me was, and this is a little bit of a spoiler, but I'll try to phrase it. I don't know. Either assume that people have already seen it or phrase it somewhat.
Or close your ears. Obliquely. Okay, close your ears for like the
exactly.
next couple seconds. Okay.
But toward the end, whenever they pull the mask or the tear the mask off of the dead woman,
right,
to reveal the different dead woman inside, that pretty much gave it away. There were some tracking problems on that one. That one, I definitely noticed it kind
right.
of bobbling a little bit. That you know, when you're doing a something where you know you're tracking one face onto another or something like that, then
yeah,
yeah it's tough sometimes to get it to track exactly correctly.
Especially
but
when
having
you...
said that, I think. Go ahead.
I was gonna say the thing that a lot of times there's a lot of match moving nowadays, and match moving is the recreation of a. It's taking the live action camera move and then recreating it in a 3D camera so that you can add 3D elements that'll snap on. And that being able to do that to the entire camera move, so something like some of the big building shots and anytime you're adding CG to a big camera move, that's actually a technology that's gotten pretty good. The technology that's less precise and much more difficult is what we call matchimation, which is trying to keep the trying to track an actual object in the scene and getting every little detail to lock in
track something that's moving, particularly something that's moving, you know, not as a solid monolithic object like a building or even a chair, but something like a face,
right?
Trying to get an accurate match on that, and I'm sure that's what it was. Is you know, it's very tough to get that. But like I was saying, having said that about that particular shot, I thought probably one of the other best shots out of the film was the other kind of face mask,
right.
the one where they put the mask on Tom Cruise, where he's then supposed to look like the bad guy. What's the actor's name?
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah. And I thought it was a really nice shot. It's sort of it's Tom Cruise is sitting in a chair, and then they put this the mask over his head, which is starts off, of course, as just an actual rubber mask, but the camera keeps traveling around his head. Kind of does it, I think, a couple of 360s around. He's talking the whole time. Somebody's talking to him, and sort of throughout the duration of that, somebody's patting the mask down and effectively attaching it. And by the time the camera does its sort of double rotate, you are on Philip Seymour Hoffman instead of on Tom Cruise.
And it was seamless. I mean, I just thought that was,
it really was.
It was a beautiful
was very
shot.
Nice shot.
I have to admit, the thing that jumped out at me the most was just how they really did some stuff that is really complicated. So they, now one thing they did do, and this is something that you want to look at when you watch movies, when you're looking at how they're setting up a lot of the effects, some effects aren't as hard as they look because creative editing can allow you to. A lot of times when someone is getting hit by something and they're falling down, you'll notice that you actually see enough of them they're just sitting up and falling. And then we shoot you another angle and then we cut to you and you never feel like it's a problem as a viewer. In this way, where they cheated here was, of course, the camera pans behind Vin's back. So it goes behind the actor's back that's applying the stuff. And so what happens is it uses that as a transition to go from Tom Cruise to Philip Seymour Hoffman. So there's this transition mode where they're now using different actors. Then on top of those, I think there's a great article. What was the article? Was it VFX World?
VFX World, yeah.
I guess they then had a digital prosthetic that's being tracked onto Philip Seymour Hoffman's face that is adding
right.
the little details that make it look like they're pushing, skin down and so on and so forth.
Yeah, so they had, prosthetic stuff, they had a full CG mask, they had the, the rubber mask, and of course they had the two main actors. I'm assuming there's a motion control on the motion control camera that, was a repeatable move
right.
for all of these different things, but maybe not. It could have been.
I think it was one. I think it was just one shot. I don't think it ever went behind him. I think it was like a big pan, like a big kind of orbiting pan. As I remember, it was just basically covered about 180 degrees, always focused on the head, but going behind one of the actors, and it's
I think you're right. Yeah,
and it was, but it was just a, I thought, yeah, just a fantastic, a shot. Now, I guess another, you know, obviously the one that you wouldn't think of as a great visual effect shot, that was a lot of great visual effect shots, is the whole Virginia Bridge sequence,
yep.
which I thought was really seamless. For the
movie. Yeah, it was nice, and it turns out that you know, that basically none of the actors were ever on that bridge.
Yeah. So when you watch it, you want to think about that. I mean, none of the actors were ever there. Now, they built, I guess, a huge, they built a huge mock-up.
It was, yeah, I mean, they actually rebuilt a good chunk of the bridge to scale, you know, full-size version of that bridge out in a field somewhere in California, in the, you know, middle of nowhere.
There's nothing like having a $150 million budget that,
yeah.
I mean, just as an aside, you know, when they did the highway chase, I think in one of the Matrix films, I guess someone they brought a contractor out and asked him how, he said, you know, we want to rebuild 2 miles of track, or it was a 3/4 mile of a track, or whatever the length was, and we want it to look like this, and we want it to have this, and he goes, and the guy looks at him and goes, that's going to cost you like $2 to $5 million, and they asked him, Joe, is that a cashier's check, or do you want us to call, you know, like that?
Yep.
It was kind of outside of the contractor's realm of possibility, but not out of theirs. And so anyway, but that they built that all out, and then I guess they well, a lot of times you'll notice that a lot of the shots are the way that they're framed, you really only see the sky.
It was a nice setup that lent itself well to that, because you know, on this bridge, I mean, the bridge is obviously elevated, so you wouldn't tend to see the ground from being on the bridge. So I think that probably helped them a lot in not having to, you know, put stuff out there. And then on those shots where, I mean, there's a couple shots where I'd be willing to bet that they were almost entirely synthetic. You know, some of the top-down shots or tracking with the missile as it flew through and everything.
Right. And it did look, it looked great. Now another one that has, that's really big, is of course the helicopter shot. So there's a helicopter shot over Shanghai, I think it's in the opening of the trailer. So it's not,
it
like
is, yeah.
There's not really much of a spoiler. They're there. And with, you know, with that shot, evidently, I guess, you know, Tom was, never actually there, right?
Tom was the guy I talked to said, Tom Cruise was never on any rooftop of any skyscraper ever.
Evidently, he did jump off of some kind of mock-up, right? I mean, that was the...
Yeah, you're hearing a lot of talk about how Tom does his own stunts, and the people I talked to said that is absolutely true. It's just that most of these stunts are, you know, more on a green screen stage or something like that. But, you know, even so, I mean, some of it's impressive work, and I think the... you know, there's a scene in the movie where Tom leaps off the edge of a building, and he really did do that. I mean, with a bungee cord kind of thing attached to him, and apparently he really did that off of like a 5 or 6 story tall mock-up building that they had done. And then, of course, the effects artist's job is then to make that, you know, 100 stories tall and set it in the middle of Shanghai instead of in the you know, MGM lot or wherever it was done.
And I guess for the most part, I, from what I understand, most of those Shanghai shots aren't really, of course, I mean, they're not really helicopter shots in Shanghai. I mean, there might be some helicopter stuff, but a lot of it's all digitally recreated, right?
Yeah, I think it sounded to me like pretty much the, I mean, they shot a lot of stuff in Shanghai, but it was almost all stuff they shot to recreate Shanghai digitally. So even that shot, that we're talking about is the one that starts off, you know, fairly far back from the building. It's a helicopter shot, and it comes in towards the building, and then you see that Tom Cruise is standing on the edge of the building, looking out at the city, and then the camera actually comes all the way up to Tom Cruise and it does circle around. I think that's the shot I was thinking of, where the camera circles around him maybe a couple times, and he's looking out at, you know, all of Shanghai below him. And you know, the way it was really shot was the first thing they did was shoot a helicopter, you know, point of view from a helicopter towards that building. They shot that in HD, it turns out, instead of film. The bulk of the film was shot, the bulk of the movie was shot on film. But
I want to say one thing about that, by the way, is mm-hmm. I actually watched this as a digital projection. Mm-hmm. And if given the choice, I would never watch another film. Like film projected on film, you know, projected on the screen again.
Yeah,
I couldn't figure out what was wrong with the image for like the first 10 minutes until I realized there was no scratches.
It's not bouncing around.
There's no dust. It was just perfectly clear. And anyway, so, but I just had to say, it was just the digital projection is just amazing. But
it is nice. Yeah. You know, the worst thing that they do with digital projection is the commercials they show at the beginning.
Yeah.
Somebody decided, oh, well, if it's, you know, digital projection, we can just go ahead and toss some, you know, television resolution stuff up there.
Right.
Remember the first time I went and saw a digital projection, it was, you know, my first experience of it was they tossed some commercial up there that looked like crap because it was just, you know, standard low resolution TV stuff.
Right.
And you're like, oh, I hope the whole movie's not going to look like this. And it didn't. But, you know, I think they're making a mistake by, I think they're making a mistake by showing commercials anyway, but, you know.
Well, I think the Metreon actually here doesn't show any. They just show the previews that they have digitally and then they just play it out. So it's,
that's the way to do it.
Anyway, so to get back to the shot here, so what they did is they took a lot of stills of the scene, and they did what's called, well, we tend to call digital mat or digi mat, I think, but it's basically what we tend to refer to it as 2.5D. So it's really not a 3D model of the. They're not building like what you would think of as a traditional 3D model of the building or the scene behind it. It's a lot of simple structures that are then that then have the photographs all pasted, you know, basically projected onto them. I don't know if you want to add anything to that or not, but that's
pretty much that. It you know means that you don't have to go in and do incredibly detailed models for every building where you know you put in every little window and every single detail like that. Instead, you can do a fairly, you know, monolithic kind of an object, potentially even just a, you know, big rectangular cube-like thing. But if you paste the actual image of the building on that, it looks quite real. And especially if it's, you know, moving footage, and you know, you sort of layer these different pieces out there. And a lot of the stuff in the distance is they would shoot different footage of different pieces of the city and put that out there. So you still have the moving cars, but they're not really. And they're just projected onto some flat surface off in the distance. And if you put enough of those things up there so that as the camera moves around, you still get the parallax kind of a shift where things move at different speeds relative to the camera, depending on how far away they are. It's a very convincing illusion, but you don't have to go to the detail of modeling every single thing in the distance.
And this is really one of the secrets of a lot of these visual effects films. I mean, I think that digital matte painters in general are kind of a very unknown secret society, you know, where there's not very many of them. There's not many people who do this very well, but there is a lot of shots. I mean, and a lot of the stuff that you see that creates the scale that you see is not really what you would consider traditional heavy-duty 3D. It really is a lot of this digital mat work. Now, here, I believe, if I read correctly, they used a lot of HDR, right? I mean, for building the source plates.
Yeah, I think at least for some of the still footage they shot, I think they had there's a rig that a lot of different facilities have that will, you know, go out and shoot multiple exposures, you know, just on a still camera, your basic digital SLR, but you shoot several exposures, you know, overexposed and underexposed, and you combine those to get what you call a high dynamic range image, something that, you know, has detail down into the darks and also sort of doesn't blow out in the bright areas in most scenes where you've got a pretty good dynamic range. That can be a problem. And so this camera sits on a little robot rig, and it takes a bunch of pictures in one direction, and then it rotates a few degrees and then takes another set of pictures, and it just does this and builds up this set of images that represent the full 360-degree view. And it gives you your world then that you can sort of build up from there.
And once you build, and what you do is then build into it. And the reason that you want that high, some of the listeners are probably wondering, why do we want all that dynamic range? And the main thing is so that you can make adjustments. You may decide later that you want it to be a little brighter or darker. You want to be able to pull detail out of it. You know, you might want to bring stuff up. It can be very difficult, especially if you're going to recreate the scene. There's a lot of different ways you may want to see it, and it's just a simple 8-bit image that you would normally get just won't have enough information to do anything particularly useful with.
You really want to get as much of the real, you know, as much of the real world data that's out there into your digital world so that you can do what you need to with it.
And so that's how they put a lot of that stuff together, and hopefully we'll be able to do some. We'll talk more about. I mean, we'll talk about digital mat, I think, a lot. So it's a big it's something that you use all the time, and most of the time it's done pretty well.
And I think this, you know, this was that shot is a perfect example of it, because mm-hmm. it really felt like you're in the place. And Robert Hoffmeister was the sequence supervisor on that, and he's, you know, I think he did a really great job of putting you in the scene.
It was really seamless. I think that the only thing I noticed, the only reason I knew it was digital, because I went through, when I first saw it, I was like, oh, I wonder if, you know, how far they went with this. And the only thing that I noticed was that they got a little bit of the compositing haircut, you know, which is, you know, on a couple of the shots. And what I'm talking about there, for those of you who don't do compositing, is that when someone's in front of a green screen, one of the things you're going to notice is that, especially if they walk from being not in front of a green screen to being in front of a green screen, you'll notice all the little wifty hair that they had before just kind of either it will go away and you'll just see most of the major detail. And this is super subtle stuff, so a lot of times it's just mm-hmm. barely noticeable. But it'll go away, or it'll become it'll disappear and appear.
Just the character will change a little bit. It just ends up feeling a little bit different,
a little thicker. It doesn't look quite as wispy. And when you know what you're looking for, you see it all the time. And it can be really good. I mean, it can be just very, very subtle, and it's something like Mission Impossible. It can be really bad on a lot of TV shows because they're shooting on less data. They have less time. They have you know all those things. It's a really hard to do well, and so it's one of those things that isn't easy. But a lot of times, if you're looking to whether I don't know if this is a compositing shot, if you look really, really closely at that hair, you'll notice whether there's no wispies, no wifty, you know, no little single hair sticking out. There's a high probability that they're comping something. So
yeah, but I thought it was actually quite good. I mean, I've seen
I've seen way worse.
A lot of places where that would, although I can't, you know, you do have to acknowledge the fact that these weren't, your worst case scenario is having a woman with, you know, light blonde hair standing up on a roof with it blowing around. And so it is definitely a little bit easier having, you know, it was Tom Cruise with his fairly straight, non-wispy black, jet black hair up there. And then, you know, I think Ving Rhames was up there too. So there was not a whole lot of wispy hair coming off of him either. So it probably did make it a little bit easier than if you had some blonde woman up there. But still, I thought it looked
good. And I will say that the compositing in Mission Impossible 3, I thought was, I mean, overall, it was just incredibly seamless. Very, nice. Very, very well done. Yep. So it was a really, really good piece overall. I mean, I really felt challenged to even find stuff that wasn't working. I really had to look for it. If I hadn't been doing this, I probably would have been able to just watch the movie and not really feel like it was, not feel much of anything. And I don't go to many films and feel that way. So I thought, overall, I thought it was just a fantastic work. That's it. I think, I don't know if I have anything else. Do you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, I think that kind of covers, you know, the highlights of it.
All right. Well, for all of you listening, next week we'll dig into another one. I don't know if we have a schedule. I don't know if we haven't decided what we're going to go watch this week. I'm not even sure what's releasing this week. I've been so busy this week.
I think Poseidon might be coming out next. So
is it?
That might be a good one. Yeah.
If that's the one released, then we'll cover that next week. And, So thank you very much, Ron.
Thank you.
This is Ron Brinkman and down in LA, and this is Alex Lindsay here in San Francisco. And until next time, we will, I wanted to say something like, you know, save the seat for us or something like that, but let's
keep the seat warm.
Yeah, exactly. So keep your eyes open and find those details for us. And I think that's it. Goodbye.